reflect our transitory passions. The job of the judiciary is to interpret the laws, or in this case, the constitutional principles embodied in those laws, as they apply to reality. In Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court went too far. It legislated, it changed the law in a way not anticipated by the drafters, and that was an error. All a reversal of Roe will do is return the abortion issue to the state legislatures where it belongs.
How long have you been thinking about that speech? Arnie asked.
Ryan's turn of phrase was too polished for extemporaneous speech.
A little while, the president admitted.
Well, when that decision comes through, be ready for a firestorm, his chief of staff warned. I'm talking demonstrations, TV coverage, and enough newspaper editorials to paper the walls of the Pentagon. And your Secret Service people will worry about the additional danger to your life, and your wife's life, and your kids. If you think I'm kidding, ask them.
Well, that doesn't make any sense.
There's no law, federal, state, or local, which compels the world to be logical, Jack. The people out there depend on you to keep the fucking weather pleasant, and they blame you when you don't. Deal with it. With that, an annoyed chief of staff headed out and west toward his corner office.
Crap, Ryan breathed,
as he flipped to the briefing papers for the Secretary of the Interior. Smokey Bear's owner. Also custodian of the national parks, which the president only got to see on the Discovery Channel, on such nights as he had free time to switch the TV on. There wasn't much to be said for the clothing people wore in this place, Nomuri thought again, except for one thing. When you undid the buttons and found the Victoria's Secret stuff underneath, well, it was like having a movie switch from black and white to Technicolor. This time Ming allowed him to do her buttons, then slide the jacket down her arms, and then get her trousers off. The panties looked particularly inviting, but then so did her entire body. Nomuri scooped her up in his arms and kissed her passionately before dropping her on the bed. A minute later, he was beside her.
"So, why were you late?"
She made a face.
"Every week Minister Fang meets with other ministers, and when he comes back, he has me transcribe the notes of the meetings so that he has a record of everything that was said."
"Oh, do you use my new computer for that?"
The question concealed the quivering Jesus he felt throughout his body on hearing Ming's words. This girl could be one hell of a source. Nomuri took a deep breath and resumed his poker face of polite disinterest.
"Of course."
"Excellent. It's equipped with a modem, yes?"
"Of course. I use it every day to retrieve Western news reports and such from their media websites."
"Ah, that is good." So he'd taken care of business for the day, and with that job done, Nomuri leaned over for a kiss.
"Before I came into the restaurant, I put the lipstick on," Ming explained. "I don't wear it at work."
"So I see," the CIA officer replied, repeating the initial kiss, and extending it in time. Her arms found their way around his neck. The reason for her lateness had nothing to do with a lack of affection. That was obvious now, as his hands started to wander also. The front closure on the bra was the smartest thing he'd done. Just a flick of thumb and forefinger and it sprang open, revealing both of her rather cute breasts, two more places for his hand to explore. The skin there was particularly silky, and, he decided a few seconds later, tasty as well. This resulted in an agreeable moan and squirm of pleasure from his, what, friend? Well, okay, but not enough. Agent? Not yet. Lover would do for the moment. They'd never talked at the farm about this sort of thing, except the usual warnings not to get too close to your agent, lest you lose your objectivity. But if you didn't get a little bit close, you'd never recruit the agent, would you? Of course, Chester knew that he was far more than a little bit close at the moment. Whatever her looks, she had delightful skin,
and his fingertips examined it in great detail as his eyes smiled into hers, with the occasional kiss. And her body wasn't bad at all, a nice shape even when she stood. A little too much waist, maybe, but this wasn't Venice Beach. And the hourglass figure, however nice it might look in pictures, was just that, a picture look. Her waist was smaller than her hips, and that was enough for the moment. It wasn't as though she'd be walking down the ramp at some New York fashion show, where the models looked like boys anyway. So Ming is not now and would never be a supermodel. Deal with it, Chet, the officer told himself. Then it was time to put all the CIA stuff aside. He was a man dressed only in boxer shorts, next to a woman dressed only in panties. Panties large enough, maybe, to make a handkerchief, though orange-red wouldn't be a good color for a man to pull from his back pocket. Especially, he added to himself with a smile, in some artificial silk fabric.
"Why do you smile?" Ming asked.
"Because you are pretty," Nomori replied. And so she was, now, with that particular smile on her face. No, she'd never be a model, but inside every woman was the look of beauty, if only they would let it out. And her skin was first class, especially her lips, coated with after-work lipstick, smooth and greasy, yet making his lips linger even so. Soon their bodies touched almost all over, and a warm, comfortable feeling it was. So nicely she fit under one arm, while his left hand played and wandered. Ming's hair didn't tangle much. She could evidently brush it out very easily, it was so short. Her underarms, too, were hairy, like many Chinese women's, but that only gave Nomori something else to play with, teasing and pulling a little. That evidently tickled her. Ming giggled playfully and hugged him tighter, then relaxed to allow his hand to wander more. As it passed her navel, she lay suddenly still, relaxing herself in some kind of invitation. Time for another kiss as his fingertips wandered farther. And there was humor in her eyes now. What game could this be? As soon as his hands found her panties, her bottom lifted off the mattress. He sat up halfway and pulled them down, allowing her left foot to kick them into the air, where the red-orange pants flew like a monocolored rainbow, and then... "Ming," he said in humorous accusation.
"I've heard that men like this," she said with a sparkle and a giggle.
"Well, it is different," Nomori replied, as his hands traced over skin even smoother than the rest of her body. "Did you do this at work?" A riotous laugh now.
"No, fool! This morning at my apartment, in my own bathroom, with my own razor."
"Just wanted to make sure," the CIA officer assured her. "Damn, isn't this something?" Then her hand moved to do to him much the same as he was doing to her.
"You are different from Fang," her voice told him in a playful whisper.
"Oh? How so?"
"I think the worst thing a woman can say to a man is, 'Are you in yet?' One of the other secretaries said that to Fang once. He beat her. She came into work the next day with black eyes. He made her come in. And then the next night, well, he had me to bed," she admitted, not so much with shame as embarrassment. "To show what a man he still is. But I knew better than to say that to him. We all do now."
"Will you say that to me?" Nomori asked with a smile and another kiss.
"Oh, no. You are a sausage, not a string bean," Ming told him enthusiastically.
It wasn't the most elegant compliment he'd ever had, but it sufficed for the moment, Nomori thought. "Do you think it's time for the sausage to find a home?"
"Oh, yes."
As he rolled on top, Nomori saw two things under him. One was a girl, a young woman with the usual female drives, which he was about to answer. The other was a potential agent, with access to political intelligence such as an experienced case officer only dreamed about. But Nomori wasn't an experienced case officer. He was still a little wet behind the ears, and so he didn't know what was impossible. He'd have to worry about his potential agent, because if he ever recruited her successfully, her life would be in the gravest danger. He thought about what would happen, how her face would change as the bullet entered her brain. But no, it was too ugly. With an effort, Nomori forced the thought aside as he slipped into her. If he were to recruit her at all, he had to perform this function well. And if it made him happy too, well, that was just a bonus. "I'll think about it," POTUS promised the Secretary of the Interior, walking him to the door that led to the corridor to the left of the fireplace. "Sorry, buddy, but the money isn't there to do all that." His Sec-Interior was by no means a bad man, but it seemed he'd been captured by his departmental bureaucracy, which was perhaps the worst danger of working in Washington. He sat back down to read the papers the secretary had handed over. Of course, he wouldn't have time to read it all over himself. On a good day, he'd be able to skim through the executive summary of the documents, while the rest went to a staffer who'd go through it all and draft a report to the president. In effect, another executive summary of sorts. And from that document, typed up by a White House staff member of maybe 28 years, policy would actually be made. And that was crazy, Ryan thought angrily. He was supposed to be the chief executive of the country. He was the only one who was supposed to make policy. But the president's time was valuable. So valuable, in fact, that others guarded it for him. And really, those others guarded his time from himself, because ultimately it was they who decided what Ryan saw and didn't see. Thus, while Ryan was the chief executive, and did alone make executive policy, he made that policy often based solely on the information presented to him by others. And sometimes it worried him that he was controlled by the information that made it to his desk, rather as the press decided what the public saw, and thus had a hand in deciding what the public thought about the various issues of the day. "So, Jack, have you been captured by your bureaucracy, too?" It was hard to know, hard to tell, and hard to decide how to change the situation, if the situation existed in the first place. "Maybe that's why Arnie likes me to get out of this building to where the real people are," Jack realized. The more difficult problem was that Ryan was a foreign policy and national security expert. In those areas he felt the most competent. It was on domestic stuff that he felt disconnected and dumb. Part of that came from his personal wealth. He'd never worried about the cost of a loaf of bread or a quart of milk. All the more so in the White House, where you never saw milk in a quart container anyway, but only in a chilled glass on a silver tray, carried by a Navy steward's mate right to your hands while you sat in your easy chair. There were people out there who did worry about such things, or at least worried about the cost of putting little Jimmy through college, and Ryan, as president, had to concern himself with their worries. He had to try to keep the economy in balance so that they could earn their decent livings, could go to Disney World in the summer and the football games in the fall, and splurge to make sure there were plenty of presents under the Christmas tree every year. But how the hell was he supposed to do that? Ryan remembered a lament attributed to the Roman Emperor Caesar Augustus. On learning that he'd been declared a god, and that temples had been erected to him, and that people sacrificed to the statues of himself in those temples, Augustus angrily inquired, "When someone prays to me to cure his gout, what am I supposed to do?" The fundamental issue was how much government policy really had to do with reality. That was a question seldom posed in Washington, even by conservatives who ideologically despised the government and everything it did in domestic terms. though they were often in favor of showing the flag and rattling the national saber overseas. Exactly why they enjoyed this, Ryan had never thought about. Perhaps just to be different from liberals who flinched from the exercise of force like a vampire from the cross, but who, like vampires, liked to extend government as far as they could get away with into the lives of everyone, and so suck their blood. In reality, use the instrument of taxation to take more and more to pay for the more and more they would have the government do. And yet the economy seemed to move on, regardless of what government did. People found their jobs, most of them in the private sector, providing goods and services for which people paid voluntarily with their after-tax money. And yet public service was a phrase used almost exclusively by and about political figures, almost always the elected sort. Didn't everyone out there serve the public in one way or another? Physicians, teachers, firefighters, pharmacists? Why did the media say it was just Ryan and Robbie Jackson, and the 535 elected members of the Congress? He shook his head. Damn. Okay, I know how I got here. But why the hell did I allow myself to run for election? Jack asked himself. It had made Arnie happy. It had even made the media happy. Perhaps because they loved him as a target, the president asked himself. And Kathy had not been cross with him about it. But why the hell had he ever allowed himself to be stampeded into this? He fundamentally didn't know what he was supposed to do as president. He had no real agenda, and sort of bumped along from day to day, making tactical decisions, for which he was singularly unqualified, instead of large strategic ones. There was nothing important he really wanted to change about his country. Oh, sure, there were a few problems to be fixed. Tax policy needed rewriting, and he was letting George Winston ramrod that. And defense needed firming up, and he had Tony Brentano working on that. He had a presidential commission looking at health care policy, which his wife, actually, was overseeing in a distant way, along with some of her Hopkins colleagues, and all of that was kept quiet. And there was that very black look at Social Security, being guided by Winston and Mark Gant. The third rail of American politics, he thought again. Step on it and die. But Social Security was something the American people really cared about, not for what it was, but for what they wrongly thought it to be. And actually, they knew that their thoughts were wrong, judging by the polling data. As thoroughly mismanaged as any financial institution could possibly be, it was still part of a government promise made by the representatives of the people to the people. And somehow, despite all the cynicism out there, which was considerable, the average Joe citizen really did trust his government to keep its word. The problem was that union chiefs and industrialists who dipped into pension funds and gone to federal prison for it had done nothing compared to what succeeding Congresses had done to Social Security. But the advantage of a crook in Congress was that he or she was not a crook. Not legally. After all, Congress made the law. Congress made government policy. And those things couldn't be wrong, could they? Yet another proof that the drafters of the Constitution had made one simple but far-reaching error. They'd assumed that the people selected by the people to manage the nation would be as honest and honorable as they'd been. One could almost hear the oops emanating from all those old graves. The people who drafted the Constitution had sat in a room dominated by George Washington himself, and whatever honor they'd lacked, he'd probably provided from his own abundant supply, just by sitting there and looking at them. The current Congress had no such mentor-slash-living-god to take George's place, and more was the pity, Ryan thought. The mere fact that Social Security had shown a profit up through the 1960s had meant that, well, Congress couldn't let a profit happen, could it? Profits were what made rich people, who had to be bad people because no one grew rich without having exploited someone or other, right? Which never stopped members of the Congress from going to those people for campaign contributions, of course. rich, and so profits had to be spent. And so Social Security taxes, properly called premiums because Social Security was actually called OASDI, for Old Age, Survivors, and Disability Insurance, were transformed into general funds to be spent along with everything else. One of Ryan's students from his days of teaching history at the Naval Academy had sent him a small plaque to keep on his White House desk. It read, "The American Republic will endure until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's money." Alexis de Tocqueville. Ryan paid heed to it. There were times when he wanted to grab Congress by its collective neck and throttle it. But there was no single such neck, and Arnie never tired of telling him how tame a Congress he had, the House of Representatives especially, which was the reverse of how things usually went. The President grumbled and checked his daily schedule for his next appointment. As with everything else, the President of the United States lived a schedule determined by others, his appointments made weeks in advance, the daily briefing pages prepared the day before so that he'd know who the hell was coming in, and what the hell he, she, or they wanted to talk about, and also what his considered position, mainly drafted by others, was. The President's position was usually a friendly one, so that the visitors, could leave the Oval Office feeling good about the experience, and the rules were that you couldn't change the agenda, lest the chief executive say, "What the hell are you asking me for now?" This would alarm both the guest and the Secret Service agents standing right behind them, hands close to their pistols, just standing there like robots, faces blank but scanning, ears taking everything in. After their shift ended, they probably headed off to whatever cop bar they frequented to chuckle over what the City Council President of Podunk had said in the Oval Office that day. "Jesus, did you see the boss's eyes when that dumb bastard..." Because they were bright, savvy people, who in many ways understood his job better than he did, Ryan reflected. Well, they should. They had the double advantage of having seen it all, and not being responsible for any of it. "Lucky bastards," Jack thought, standing for his next appointment. If cigarettes were good for anything, it was for this, Nomori thought. His left arm was curled around Ming, his body snuggled up against her, staring at the ceiling in the lovely, relaxed, deflationary moment, and puffing gently on his cool, as an accent to the moment, feeling Ming's breathing, and feeling very much like a man. The sky outside the windows was dark. The sun had set. Nomori stood, stopping first in the bathroom and then heading to the kitchenette. He returned with two wine glasses. Ming sat up in bed and took a sip from hers. For his part, Nomori couldn't resist reaching over to touch her. Her skin was just so smooth and inviting. "My brain is still not working," she said after her third sip. "Darling, there are times when men and women don't need their brains." "Well, your sausage doesn't need one," she responded, reaching down to fondle it. "Gently, girl. He's run a long, hard race," the CIA officer warned her with an inner smile.
"Oh, so he has."
Ming bent down to deliver a gentle kiss.
"And he won the race?"
"No, but he did manage to catch up with you." Nomori lit another cigarette. Then he was surprised to see Ming reach into her purse and pull out one of her own. She lit it with grace and took a long puff, finally letting the smoke out her nose. "Dragon girl," Nomori announced with a laugh. "Do flames come next? I didn't know you smoked."
"At the office, everyone does."
"Even the minister?" Another laugh.
"Especially the minister."
"Someone should tell him that smoking is dangerous to the health, and not good for the yang."
"A smoked sausage is not a firm sausage," Ming said with a laugh. "Maybe that's his problem, then."
"You do not like your minister?"
"He is an old man with what he thinks is a young penis.
He uses the office staff as his personal bordello.
Well, it could be worse, Ming admitted.
It's been a long time since I was his favorite. Lately he's fixed on Chai, and she is engaged, and Fang knows it. That is not a civilized act on the part of a senior minister.
The laws do not apply to him?
She snorted with borderline disgust.
The laws apply to none of them. Nomori-san, these are government ministers. They are the law in this country, and they care little for what others think of them or their habits. Few enough find out in any case.
They are corrupt on a scale that shames the emperors of old. And they say they are the guardians of the common people, the peasants and workers they claim to love as their own children.
Well, I suppose sometimes I am one of those peasants, eh?
And I thought you liked your minister, Nomori responded, goading her on. So, what does he talk about?
What do you mean?
The late work that kept you away from here, he answered, waving at the bedclothes with a smile.
Oh, talk between the ministers. He keeps an extensive personal political diary, in case the president might want to oust him. That is his defense, you see. Something he could present to his peers. Fang doesn't want to lose his official residence and all the privileges that come along with it. So he keeps records of all he does, and I am his secretary, and I transcribe all his notes. Sometimes it can take forever.
On your computer, of course.
Yes, the new one. In perfect Mandarin ideographs, now that you've given us the new software.
You keep it on your computer?
On the hard drive, yes.
Oh, it's encrypted, she assured him. We learned that from the Americans when we broke into their weapons records. It's called a robust encryption system, whatever that means. I select the file I wish to open and type in the decryption key, and the file opens.
Do you want to know what key I use?
She giggled.
Yellow submarine. In English, because of the keyboard. It was before your new software, and it's from a Beatles song I heard on the radio once. We all live in a yellow submarine. Something like that. I listened to the radio a lot back then, when I was first studying English. I spent half an hour looking up submarines in the dictionary, and then the encyclopedia, trying to find out why a ship was painted yellow.
Ah!
Her hands flew up in the air.
The encryption key. Nomori tried to hide his excitement.
"Well, it must be a lot of folders. You've been his secretary for a lot of time," he said casually.
"Over 400 documents. I keep them by number instead of making up new names for them. Today was number 487, as a matter of fact."
"Holy shit," Nomori thought. 487 computer documents of inside the Politburo conversations. This makes a gold mine look like a toxic waste dump.
What exactly do they talk about?
I've never met a senior government functionary, Nomori explained.
Everything, she answered, finishing her own cigarette. Who's got ideas in the Politburo? Who wants to be nice to America? Who wants to hurt them? Everything you can imagine. Defense policy, economic policy. The big one lately is how to deal with Hong Kong. One country, two systems has developed problems with some industrialists around Beijing and Shanghai. They feel they are treated with less respect than they deserve. Less than they get in Hong Kong, that is. And they are unhappy about it. Fang's one of the people trying to find a compromise to make them happy. He might. He's very clever at such things.
It must be fascinating to see such information, to really know what's going on in your country, Nomori gushed.
In Japan, we never know what the Zaibatsu and the Meaty people are doing, ruining the economy for the most part, the fools. But because nobody knows, no action is ever taken to fix things.
Is it the same here?
Of course.
She lit another smoke, getting into the conversation, and hardly noticing that it wasn't about love anymore.
Once I studied my Marx and my Mao. Once I believed in it all.
Once I even trusted the senior ministers to be men of honor and integrity, and totally believed the things they taught me in school. But then I saw how the army has its own industrial empire, and that empire keeps the generals rich and fat and happy. And I saw how the ministers use women, and how they furnish their apartments. They've become the new emperors. They have too much power. Perhaps a woman could use such power without being corrupted, but not a man.
Feminism's made it over here, too, Nomori reflected.
Maybe she was too young to remember Mao's wife, Zhang Qing, who could have given corruption lessons to the court of Byzantium.
Well, that is not a problem for people like us. At least you get to see such things, and at least you get to know it.
That makes you even more unique, Ming Chan, Nomori suggested, tracing the palm of his hand over her left nipple.
She shivered right on command.
You think so?
Of course.
A kiss this time, a nice lingering one, while his hand stroked her body. He was so close. She had told him of all the information she had. She'd even given him the fucking encryption key.
So her pewter was wired into the phone system. That meant he could call into it. And with the right software, he could go snooping around her hard drive. And with the encryption key, he could lift things right off and cross-load them right to Mary Pat's desk.
Damn, first I get to fuck a Chinese citizen, and then I can fuck their whole country.
It didn't get much better than this, the field spook decided, with a smile at the ceiling.
Chapter 13 Penetration Agent.
Well, he left the prurient parts out this time, Mary Pat saw when she lit up her computer in the morning. Operation Zorga was moving right along. Whoever this Ming girl was, she talked a little too much. Odd. Hadn't the MSS briefed all the executive secretaries about this sort of thing? Probably. It would have been a remarkable oversight if they hadn't. But it also seemed likely that of the well-known reasons for committing treason and espionage, known as MICE, money, ideology, conscience, and ego, this one was ego. Young Miss Ming was being used sexually by her minister Fang, and she didn't much like it. And that made perfect sense to Mary Patricia Foley. A woman only had so much to give, and to have it taken coercively by a man of power wasn't something calculated to make a woman happy. Though, ironically, the powerful man in question probably thought he was honoring her with his biological attention. After all, was he not a great man? And was she not a peasant? The thought was good for a snort as she took a sip of morning seventh-floor coffee. It didn't matter what culture or race, men were all the same, weren't they? So many of them thought from the dick instead of the brain. Well, it was going to cost this one dearly, the deputy director, operations, concluded. Ryan saw and heard the PDB, the president's daily brief, every day. It covered intelligence information developed by CIA, was prepared late every night and printed early every morning. And there were less than 100 copies, almost all of which were shredded and burned later in the day of delivery. A few copies, maybe 3 or 4, were kept as archives, in case the electronic files somehow got corrupted. But even President Ryan didn't know where the secure storage site was. He hoped it was carefully guarded, preferably by Marines. The PDB didn't contain everything, of course. Some things were so secret that even the president couldn't be trusted. That was something Ryan accepted with remarkable equanimity. Sources' names had to remain secret, even from him, and methods were often so narrowly technical that he'd have trouble understanding the technology used anyway.
But even some of the take, the information obtained by the CIA through nameless sources and overly intricate methods, was occasionally hidden from the chief executive, because some information had to come from a certain limited number of sources. The intelligence business was one in which the slightest mistake could end the life of a priceless asset. and while such things had happened, nobody had ever felt good about it. Though to some politicians it had been a matter of infuriating indifference. A good field spook viewed his agents as his own children, whose lives were to be protected against all hazards. Such a point of view was necessary. If you didn't care that much, then people died. And with their lost lives went lost information, which was the whole point of having a clandestine service in the first place. "Okay, Ben," Ryan said, leaning back in his chair and flipping through the PDB pages. "What's interesting?" "Mary Pat has something happening in China. Not sure what it is, though. She's keeping these cards pretty close. The rest of today's document you can get on CNN." Which was, depressingly, not infrequently the case. On the other hand, the world was fairly sedate, and penetrating information wasn't all that necessary. Or apparently so, Ryan corrected himself. You could never tell. He'd learned that one at Langley, too. "Maybe I'll call her about it," POTUS said, flipping the page. "Whoa! The Russian oil and gas? Are these numbers for real?" "It appears so. They track with what Trader's been feeding us from his sources, step for step." Ryan breathed, looking over the resulting forecasts for the Russian economy. Then he frowned with some disappointment. "George's people did a better evaluation of results." "Think so? CIA's economics troops have a pretty decent track record." "George lives in that business. That's better than being an academic observer of events, Ben. Academia is fine, but the real world is the real world, remember?" Goodley nodded. "Duly noted, sir." "Throughout the 80s, CIA overestimated the Soviet economy. Know why?" "No, I don't. What went wrong?" Jack smiled wryly. "It wasn't what was wrong. It was what was right. We had an agent back then who fed us the same information the Soviet Politburo got. It just never occurred to us that the system was lying to itself. The Politburo based its decisions on a chimera. Their numbers were almost never right because the underlings were covering their own asses. Oops." "Same thing in China, you suppose?" Goodley asked. "They're the last really Marxist country, after all." "Good question. Call Langley and ask. You'll get an answer from the same sort of bureaucrat the Chinese have in Beijing. But to the best of my knowledge, we don't have a penetration agent in Beijing who can give us the numbers we want." Ryan paused and looked at the fireplace opposite his desk. He'd have to have the Secret Service put a real fire in it someday. "No, I expect the Chinese have better numbers. They can afford to. Their economy is working after a fashion. They probably deceive themselves in other ways. But they do deceive themselves. It's a universal human characteristic, and Marxism doesn't ameliorate it very much. Even in America, with its free press and other safeguards, reality often slapped political figures in the face, hard enough to loosen some teeth. Everywhere people had theoretical models based on ideology rather than facts, and those people usually found their way into academia or politics, because real-world professions punished that sort of dreamer more than politics ever did.
"Morning, Jack," a voice said from the corridor door.
"Hey, Robbie." POTUS pointed to the coffee tray. Vice President Jackson got himself a cup, but passed on the croissants. His waistline looked a little tight. Well, Robbie had never looked like a marathoner. So many fighter pilots tended to have thick waists. Maybe it was good for fighting G-forces, Jack speculated.
"Read the PDB this morning, Jack, this Russian oil and gold thing. Is it really that big?"
"George says it's even bigger. You ever sit down with him to learn economics?"
End of the week, we're going to play around at Burning Tree, and I'm reading Milton Friedman and two other books to bone up for it. You know, George comes across as pretty smart. Smart enough to make a ton of money on the street. And I mean, if you put his money in $100 bills and weigh them, it is a fucking ton of money.
Must be nice, breathed a man, who'd never made more than $130,000 in a year before taking on his current job.
Has its moments, but the coffee here is still pretty good.
It was better on Big John once upon a time.
Where?
John F. Kennedy, back when I was in 03, and doing fun work, like driving tomcats off the boat.
Robbie, hate to tell you, my friend, but you're not 26 anymore.
Jack, you have such a way of brightening up my days for me. I've walked past death's door before, but it's safer and a hell of a lot more fun to do it with a fighter plane strapped to your back.
What's your day look like?
Believe it or not, I have to drive down to the Hill and preside at the Senate for a few hours just to show I know what the Constitution says I'm supposed to do. Then a dinner speech in Baltimore about who makes the best brassieres, he added with a smile.
What? Jack asked, looking up from the PDB.
The thing about Robbie's sense of humor was that you never really knew when he was kidding.
National meeting of artificial fiber manufacturers. They also make bulletproof vests, but bras get most of their fibers, or so my research staff tells me. They're trying to make a few jokes for the speech.
Work on your delivery, the president advised the vice president.
You thought I was funny enough way back when, Jackson reminded his old friend.
Rob, I thought I was funny enough way back when, but Arnie tells me I'm not sensitive enough.
I know, no Polish jokes. Some Polacks learned to turn on their TVs last year, and there's 6 or 7 who know how to read. That doesn't count the Polish gal who doesn't use a vibrator because it chips her teeth.
Jesus, Robbie.
Ryan almost spilled his coffee, laughing.
We're not even allowed to think things like that anymore.
Jack, I'm not a politician. I'm a fighter jock. I got the flight suit, the hack watch, and the dick to go along with the job title, you dig?
The vice president asked with a grin.
And I am allowed to tell a joke once in a while.
Fine, just remember this isn't the ready room on the Kennedy. The media lacks the sense of humor enjoyed by naval aviators.
Yeah, unless they catch us in something. Then it's funnier in hell, the retired vice admiral observed.
Rob, you're finally catching on. Glad to see it.
Ryan's last sight of the departing subordinate was the back of a nicely tailored suit, accompanied by a muttered vulgarity.
"So, Misha, any thoughts?" Provolov asked.
Riley took a sip of his vodka. "It was awfully smooth here."
"Oleg, you just have to shake the tree and see what falls out. It could be damn near anything, but don't know means don't know. And at the moment, we don't know."
Another sip.
"Does it strike you that 2 former Spetsnaz guys are a lot of firepower to go after a pimp?"
The Russian nodded.
"Yes, of course, I've thought of that. But he was a very prosperous pimp, wasn't he, Misha? He had a great deal of money and very many contacts inside the criminal establishment. He had power of his own. Perhaps he'd had people killed as well.
We never had his name come up in a serious way in any murder investigations, but that doesn't mean that Avseenko was not a dangerous man in his own right, and therefore worthy of such high-level attention.
Any luck with this Suvorov guy?
Provolov shook his head.
No, we have a KGB file for him and a photograph, but even if that is for the right person, we haven't found him yet.
Well, Oleg Grigorievich, it looks as though you have a real head-scratcher on your hands.
Riley lifted his hand to order another round.
You are supposed to be the expert on organized crime, the Russian lieutenant reminded his FBI guest.
That's true, Oleg, but I ain't no gypsy fortune-teller, and I ain't the Oracle of Delphi either. You don't know who the real target was yet.
and until you learn that, you don't know jack shit. Problem is, to find out who the target was, you have to find somebody who knows something about the crime. The two things are wrapped up together, bro. Get one, get both. Get neither, get nothing. The drinks arrived. Riley paid and took another hit. My captain is not pleased. The FBI agent nodded. Yeah, bosses are like that in the Bureau, too, but he's supposed to know what the problems are, right? If he does, he knows he has to give you the time and the resources to play it out. How many men you have on it now?
6 here, and 3 more in St. Petersburg.
May want to get some more, bro. In the FBI's New York OC office, a case like this could have as many as 20 agents working it, half of them on a full-time basis. But the Moscow militia was stretched notoriously thin. For as much crime as there was now in Moscow, the local cops were still sucking hind tit when it came to government support. But it could have been worse. Unlike much of Russian society, the militiamen were getting paid.
"You tire me out," Nomori protested.
"There is always Minister Fang," Ming replied with a playful look.
"Ah!" was the enraged reply. "You compare me with an old man?"
"Well, both of you are men."
"But better a sausage than a string bean," she answered, grasping the former in her soft left hand. "Patience, girl. Allow me to recover from the first race." With that, he lifted her body over his and let it down.
"She must really like me," Nomori reflected. 3 nights in a row.
I suppose Fang isn't the man he thinks he is. Well, can't win 'em all, Charlie. Plus the advantage of being 40 years younger. There was probably something to that, the CIA officer admitted to himself.
"But you run so fast," Ming protested, rubbing her body on his.
"There is something I want you to do." A very playful smile.
"What might that be?"
she asked, while her hand wandered a little. "Not that."
"Oh."
The disappointment in her voice was noteworthy. "Something for work," Nomori explained on. Just as well she couldn't feel the shaking inside his body, which, remarkably enough, didn't show.
"For work? I can't bring you into the office for this," she said with a laugh,
followed by a warm, affectionate kiss. "Yes, something to upload onto your computer." Nomori reached into the night table drawer and pulled out a CD-ROM. "Here. You just load this into your machine, click install, and then dispose of it when you're done."
"And what will it do?" she asked.
"Do you care?"
"Well..."
Hesitation. She didn't understand.
"I must care."
"It will allow me to look at your computer from time to time."
"But why?"
"Because of Nippon Electric. We make your computer, don't you see?" He allowed his body to relax. "It is useful for my company to know how economic decisions are made in the People's Republic," Nomori explained, with a well-rehearsed lie. "This will allow us to understand that process a little better, so that we can do business more effectively. And the better I do for them, the more they will pay me. And the more I can spend on my darling Ming."
"I see," she thought, wrongly.
He bent down to kiss a particularly nice spot. Her body shuddered in just the right way. Good, she wasn't resisting the idea. Or at least wasn't letting it get in the way of this activity, which was good for Nomori in more than one way. The intelligence officer wondered if someday his conscience would attack him for using this girl in such a way. But business, he told himself, was business.
"No one will know."
"No, that is not possible."
"And it will not get me into trouble?"
With that question, he rolled over, finding himself on top. He held her face in both hands.
Would I ever do something to get Ming Chan in trouble?
Never, he announced, with a deep and passionate kiss. Afterward, there was no talk about the CD-ROM, which she tucked into her purse before leaving. It was a nice-looking purse, a knockoff of something Italian that you could buy on the street here, rather like the genuine ones in New York that fell off the back of the truck, as the euphemism went. Every time they parted, it was a little hard. She didn't want to leave, and truly he didn't want her to depart. But it was necessary. For them to share an apartment would be commented upon. Even in her dreams, Ming couldn't think of that, actually sleeping at the apartment of a foreigner, because she did have a security clearance, and she had been given her security brief by a bored MSS officer, along with all the other senior secretaries. And she hadn't reported this contact to her superiors or the office security chief as she ought to have done.
Why?
Partly because she'd forgotten the rules, because she'd never broken them or known someone who had done so, and partly because, like many people, she drew a line between her private life and her professional one. That the two were not allowed to be separate in her case was something that the MSS briefing had covered, but in so clumsy a way as to have been disregarded even upon its delivery. And so here she was, not even knowing where and what here was. With luck, she'd never have to find out, Nomori thought, watching her turn the corner and disappear from view. Luck would help. What the MSS interrogators did to young women in the Beijing version of the Lubyanka didn't really bear much contemplation. Certainly not when one had just made love to her twice in 2 hours.
Good luck, honey, Nomori whispered, as he closed the door and headed to the bathroom for a shower.
Chapter 14 .com It was a sleepless night for Nomori. Would she do it? Would she do what she was told? Would she tell a security officer about it, and then about him? Might she be caught with the CD-ROM going into work and questioned about it? If so, a casual inspection would show it to be a music CD, Bill Conti's musical score for Rocky, a poorly marked knockoff of an American intellectual property that was quite common in the PRC. But a more careful examination would have revealed that the first, outermost data line on the metallic surface told the computer CD-ROM reader to skip to a certain place where the content was not music, but binary code. And very efficient binary code at that. The CD-ROM didn't contain a virus, per se, because a virus circulates mainly across computer networks, entering a computer surreptitiously the way a disease organism enters a living host, hence the term virus. But this one came in the front door, and on being read by the CD-ROM reader, a single prompt came up on the screen, and Ming, after a quick look around in her office, moved her mouse to put the pointer on the prompt, click the install command, and everything immediately disappeared. The program thus implanted searched her hard drive at nearly the speed of light, categorizing every file and setting up its own index, then compressing it into a small file that hid in plain sight, as it were, identified by any disk-sorting program with a wholly innocent name that referred to a function carried out by another program entirely. Thus, only a very careful and directed search by a skilled computer operator could even detect that something was even there. Exactly what the program did could only be determined by a 1x0 reading of the program itself, something difficult to accomplish at best. It would be like trying to find what was wrong with a single leaf on a single tree in a vast forest where all the trees and all the leaves looked pretty much alike, except that this one leaf was smaller and humbler than most. CIA and NSA could no longer attract the best programmers in America.
There was just too much money in the consumer electronics industry for government to compete effectively in that marketplace. But you could still hire them, and the work that came out was just as good. And if you paid them enough, strangely, you could pay lots more to a contractor than to an employee. They wouldn't talk to anyone about it. And besides, they never really knew what it was all about anyway, did they? In this case, there was an additional level of complexity that went back over 60 years. When the Germans had overrun the Netherlands in 1940, they'd created a strange situation. In Holland, the Germans had found both the most cooperative of their conquered nations and the most fiercely resistant. More Dutchmen per capita had joined the Germans than any other nationality, enough to form their own SS division, SS Nordland. At the same time, the Dutch resistance became the most effective in Europe, and one of their number was a brilliant mathematician, engineer, working for the National Telephone Company. In the second decade of the 20th century, the telephone had reached a developmental roadblock. When you lifted a phone, you were immediately connected to an operator to whom you gave the destination you were trying to call, and she then physically moved a plug into the proper hole. This system had been workable when only a few telephones were in use, but the appliance had rapidly proved too useful for limited applications. The solution to the problem, remarkably enough, had come from a mortician in the American South. Vexed by the fact that the local operator in his town referred the bereaved to a competing undertaker, he had invented the stepping switch, which enabled people to reach their own phone destinations merely by turning a rotary dial. That system served the world well, but also required the development of a whole body of new mathematical knowledge called complexity theory, which was systematized by the American company AT&T in the 1930s. 10 years later, merely by adding additional digits to be dialed, the Dutch engineer in the resistance had applied complexity theory to covert operations by creating theoretical pathways through the switching gear, thus enabling resistance fighters to call others without knowing whom they called, or even the actual telephone numbers they were calling. This bit of electronic skullduggery had first been noticed by an officer for the British Special Operations Executive, the SOE, and finding it very clever indeed, he discussed it over a beer with an American colleague in a London pub. The American OSS officer, like most of the men Wild Bill Donovan had chosen, was an attorney by profession, and in his case a very thorough one, who wrote everything down and forwarded it up the line. The report on the Dutch engineer had made its way to the office of Colonel William Friedman, then America's foremost codebreaker. Though not himself a hardware expert, Friedman had known something useful when he saw it. And he knew there would be an after the war, during which his agency, later reborn as the National Security Agency, would still be busy cracking other countries' codes and ciphers and producing codes and ciphers itself. The ability to develop covert communications links through a relatively simple mathematical trick had seemed a gift from God's own hand. In the 1940s and 50s, NSA had been able to hire America's finest mathematicians, and one of the tasks assigned them had been to work with AT&T to create a universal telephone operating system that could be used covertly by American intelligence officers. Back then, AT&T was the only real rival NSA had had in the hiring of skilled mathematicians. And beyond that, AT&T had always been a prime contractor for just about every executive agency of the government. By 1955, it was done. And for a surprisingly modest fee, AT&T provided the entire world with a model for telephone systems that most of the world adopted. The modest cost was explained by the desire of AT&T to make its systems compatible with every other country's to ease international communications. With the 1970s had come push-button phones, which directed calls electronically by frequency-controlled codes even easier for electronic systems to use, and infinitely easier to maintain than the former electromechanical stepping switches that had made the mortician hugely rich. They also proved even easier for AT&T to rig for NSA. The operating systems first given the world's telephone companies by AT&T's Parsippany, New Jersey, research laboratory had been upgraded yearly at least, giving further improvements to the efficiency of the world's phone systems. So much so that scarcely any telephone system in the world didn't use it. And tucked into that operating system were 6 lines of binary code whose operational concept traced back to the Nazi occupation of Holland. Ming finished the installation and ejected the disk, discarding it into her waste can. The easy way to dispose of secret material was to have your adversary do it, through the front door, not the back one. Nothing really happened for some hours, while Ming did her usual office tasks, and Nomori visited 3 commercial businesses to sell his high-powered desktop computers. All that changed at 7:45 p.m. By this time, Ming was at her own home. Nomori would get a night off. Ming had to do some things with her roommate to avoid too much suspicion. Watching local television, chatting with her friend, and thinking about her lover, while the whole reason for the wispy smiles on her face played out entirely outside her consciousness. Strangely, it never occurred to her that her roomie had it all figured out in an instant, and was merely polite enough not to broach the subject. Her NEC desktop computer had long since gone into auto-sleep mode, leaving the monitor screen dark and blank, and the indicator light in the lower right position of the plastic frame amber instead of the green that went with real activity. The software she'd installed earlier in the day had been custom designed for the NEC machines, which, like all such machines, had proprietary source code unique to the brand. The source code, however, was known to the National Security Agency. Immediately upon installation, the Ghost program, as it had been christened at Fort Meade, Maryland, had buried itself in a special niche in the NEC's operating system, the newest version of Microsoft Windows. The niche had been created by a Microsoft employee whose favorite uncle had died over North Vietnam while flying an F-105 fighter bomber, and who did his patriotic work entirely without the knowledge of his parent company. It also dovetailed exactly with the NEC code, with the effect of making it virtually invisible even to a line-by-line inspection of all the code within the machine by an expert software engineer. The Ghost had gone immediately to work, creating a directory that sorted the documents on Ming's computer first by date of creation / modification, and then by file type. Some files, like the operating system, it ignored. It similarly ignored the NEC-created transcription program that converted Roman characters, actually the English phonemes of the spoken Mandarin language, into the corresponding ideographs. But the Ghost did not ignore the graphic text files that resulted from that program. Those it copied, along with telephone indexes and every other text file on the 5-gigabyte hard drive. This entire procedure took the machine, guided by the Ghost, 17.14 seconds, leaving a large file that sat by itself. The machine did nothing for a second and a half, then new activity started. The NEC desktop machines had built-in high-speed modems. The Ghost activated these, but also turned off their internal mini-speakers so that no evidence of the transmission would be heard by anyone. Leaving the speakers on was a primary security measure. The flashing lights that told of their activity were hidden because the modem was inside the box for this model. The computer then dialed. This term had somehow survived the demise of rotary dials on telephones, a 12-digit number, rather than the usual 7 used by the Beijing telephone system. The additional 5 digits sent the seeker signal on a round-robin adventure through the hardware of the central switching computer, and it came out in the place designated 2 weeks before by the engineers at Fort Meade, who, of course, never had an idea what this was all for, or where it would happen, or who might be involved. The number that rang—actually, there wasn't a mechanical or electronic ringer of any sort— was the dedicated modem line that exited the wall by Chester Nomori's desk and ended in the back of his very high-end laptop, which was not an NEC, because here, as with most computer applications, the best was still American. Nomori was also watching TV at the moment, though in his case it was the CNN International News, so that he could know what was going on at home. After that he'd switched to a Japanese satellite channel, because it was part of his cover. A samurai show he liked was on tonight, in theme and simplicity rather like the westerns that had polluted American TV in the 1950s. Though an educated man and a professional intelligence officer, Nomori liked mindless entertainment as much as anyone else. The beep made him turn his head. Though his computer had software similar to that running in Ming's office, he'd allowed the aural prompt to tell him that something was coming in, and a three-key code lit up his screen to show exactly what it was and where it was coming from. "Yes," the CIA officer exulted, his right fist slamming into his open left hand hard enough to sting. "Yes." He had his agent in fucking place, and here was the take from Operation Zorga. A bar at the top of the screen showed that the data was coming in at a rate of 57,000 bits per second. That was pretty fast. Now, just hope that the local commie phone system didn't develop a bad connection somewhere between Ming's office and the switching center, and from the switching center to his flat, Chester thought. Shouldn't be much of a problem. The outbound leg from Ming's office would be first rate, tasked, as it was, to the service of the party nobility. And from the switching center to his place would be okay, because he'd gotten numerous messages that way, most of them from NEC in Tokyo to congratulate him on exceeding his sales quota already. "Yeah, well, Chet, you are pretty good at making a sale, aren't you?" he asked himself on the way to the kitchen. He figured he owed himself a drink for this bit of performance. On returning, he saw that the download wasn't finished yet. "Damn, how much shit is she sending me?" Then he realized that the text files he was getting were actually graphics files, because Ming's computer didn't store ideographs as letters, but rather as the pictures that they actually were. That made the files memory-intensive. Exactly how memory-intensive they were, he saw 40 minutes later when the download ended. At the far end of the electronic chain, the ghost program appeared to shut itself down. But, in fact, it slept rather as a dog did, one ear always cocked up, and always aware of the time of day. On finishing the transmission, the ghost made a notation on its inside index of the files. It had sent everything up until this day. From now on, it would only send new ones, which would make for much shorter and faster transmissions. But only in the evening, and only after 95 minutes of total inactivity on the computer, and only when it was outwardly in autosleep mode. Tradecraft and caution had been programmed in. "Fuck," Nomori breathed on seeing the size of the download. In pictures, this could be the porno shots of damn near every hooker in Hong Kong. But his job was only half done. He lit up a program of his own and selected the preferences folder that controlled it. Already checked was the box for auto-encryption. Virtually everything on his computer was encrypted anyway, which was easily explainable as trade and business secrets. Japanese companies are renowned for the secrecy of their operations, but with some files more encrypted than others. The ones that arrived from the ghost got the most robust scrambling, from a mathematically derived transcription system, fully 512 bits in the key, plus an additional random element which Nomori could not duplicate. That was in addition to his numeric password, 51240, the street number of his first score in East L.A. Then it was time to transmit his take.